This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy.
Hundreds of years before any of our centuries, peasants and laborers in the British Isles spent the last night of October wandering from house to house with lanterns made from hollowed-out turnips. The flames represented souls trapped in purgatory, and at each house the exchange would follow something like this. You give me one of these bread loaves you've baked special for this occasion, and in exchange I'll pray for your dead relatives to be released into heaven.
Sound familiar? Well, this proto-trick-or-treat ritual was known as souling. The occasion was known as Hallowtide, and it coincided with the Catholic holy days of All Souls and All Saints. The Protestant Reformation of the 16th century officially put an end to All Souls Day, but at least in the more Catholic corners of the kingdom, souling persisted.
And so did other Hallowtide traditions like cross-dressing and practical joke playing and all-around mischief-making. Now, it's true that the more carnival-esque elements of Hallowtide have always been difficult to eradicate, even when they came to America, where they ran up against Victorian impulses that tamed other kinds of once-wild celebrations. But the holiday also has much more solemn roots, in a time when spirits from another plane were taken very seriously indeed.
And so on today's episode of Backstory, we're going to put aside the mischief and candy and devote the hour instead to Halloween's more shadowy figures. Because not only do ghosts, spirits, and witches have a history, they have an American history, and it's not just limited to Halloween. For believers, the supernatural is a year-long phenomenon.
That was certainly the case in my century, the 19th century, when belief in an active spirit plane blossomed into a full-fledged American religion. It was known as spiritualism, and while there's been plenty of debate about what to make of it, most people agree on when and where it started, 1848, in a tiny town in upstate New York. We're going to hand things over now to Nate DeMayo, here to tell the story of the Fox Sisters.
People said the house was haunted, and that was even before the two girls started talking to the dead. Kate Fox was 11, her sister Margaret was 14, when they moved into a little house in a nothing village, 40 miles east of Rochester, New York. A little house that all their neighbors knew as the one where the traveling salesman had been invited in years before, and was never heard from again. Never heard from, that is, until one night in March of 1848, when their parents first heard the sounds. Some nights it would sound like knocking, other nights like furniture moving, and it always seemed to come from the girls' bedroom. But they'd open the door and their daughters would be fast asleep. They never suspected that their daughters could be tricking them. They were just young girls. But they were tricking them. What started with a little tapping on the wall and tiptoeing back into bed, with giggles muffled by pillows, got more sophisticated as the nights went on. And on the night of March 31st, the Fox Sisters revealed the latest in their growing repertoire of ghost simulating techniques. The one that would place the two girls at the center of a cultural and religious revolution. They called their mother into the room. Margaret snapped her fingers once, and they heard a tap in response. She snapped twice, and it tapped twice. The next night, all of their neighbors squeezed into the girls' candlelit room. They explained that one tap meant yes, two taps meant no, and then they started asking questions. And in the morning, the audience left convinced that they had spent the night in the presence of a dead man and two girls with incredible powers. Mr. and Mrs. Fox wanted to protect their daughters, and they sent them to live with their responsible older sister, Leah. But they soon found that the ghosts followed the girls, and Leah found an opportunity. Soon, she had booked her little sisters in a 400-seat theater in Rochester. By 1850, they were the toast of New York City. People would wait in line for hours to ask the sisters for words of their dead loved ones on the other side. William Cullen Bryant caught their act. James Fenimore Cooper. George Ripley, though we don't know whether he believed it or not. The newspaper man Horace Greeley introduced them to New York nightlife, and in the pages of his paper, introduced them to the world. Soon people were holding seances like we hold dinner parties, But even as spiritualism was sweeping the nation, it was leaving the sisters who started it behind. On October 21st, 1888, a 54-year-old Margaret Fox sat on the stage at the New York Academy of Music in front of 2,000 paying customers and showed them all how she spoke to the dead. She told them about how 40 years before, back in that little house in the nothing town, after a few nights of knocking and tiptoeing back to bed, she and her little sister realized that they could both crack their toes, and no one could see them doing it. And that when they did, people actually believed they were hearing from dead people. Because sounds are hard to place in space, and because you'll believe pretty much anything if you really want to believe it. She revealed all of that, but not everything. She didn't tell them about how she and her little sister started to unravel. Not long after Horace Greeley introduced them to the world, and to worldly things like power and wealth and wine. She didn't tell them about how her sister began to believe that maybe there was something to it all, even as they both struggled under the growing weight of their shared secret. And she certainly didn't tell them about the night she tested her own belief, after scurvy had taken the life of a polar explorer who had taken her heart, and how she broke down and tried to contact him, tried to do for real what she had spent the last 9 years pretending to do. She didn't say how she called out to him, and how he didn't call back, and how she sat in the dark, knowing that he never would. Kate and Margaret Fox weren't forgotten, but at the times of their deaths, they weren't remembered fondly. Each died poor, neither living to see 60. The people who still clung to spiritualism were glad to see them go, and people who never believed, they were too. Now, there is a postscript here that really can't be resisted, and you can do with it what you will. They tore that little house down in 1904, and inside one of the walls, near the girl's room, they found the skeleton of a man believed to be a traveling salesman, who appeared to have been murdered a few years before the Fox family moved in. It's true.
That's Nate DeMeo. You can listen to a longer version of this story, as well as dozens more of Nate's American history vignettes, at thememorypalace.us.
You know, guys, there's actually a postscript to this story as well. A year after Margaret Fox's big confession, she sat down with a newspaper reporter and said, you know, it was actually the confession that was a hoax, that she really just did the confession for the money, and in fact, you know, those spirit rappings have been real all along. As it turned out, her recanting didn't really change many minds one way or another. Her credibility was pretty much shot by then. But what it did do is provide just enough fodder on both sides for people to continue debating this issue for generations, all the way up to the present day.
Yes, they did it. No, they didn't do it. Yes, they did it. No, they didn't do it. Back and forth over many, many years.
That's Kara Seekings. When it comes to the question of whether the Fox sisters were faking it, she's very much in the no, they didn't camp. Now, she acknowledges that the world of spirit mediums has always had its share of frauds, but she says that when you strip away the showmanship, communication with another plane really isn't all that out of the ordinary.
You know, we all grew up with that woman in our neighborhood who knew things before anybody else knew them. Mm-hmm. She knew, you know, who on the block was pregnant and who on the block didn't have enough food on the table. And she just knew things. And no matter what culture, I mean, the Italians call her a strega, for example. The Irish call her a wise woman or a seer. So there have always been those people. But I think the Fox sisters made it appear more organized.
Now, the way she tells it, Kara Seekings herself has always been one of those people. When she was 3, the spirit of her long-dead grandfather arrived and told her things she'd have no way of knowing otherwise. Ever since, she's been carrying messages to people from the other side. Seekings lives in a community of other spirit mediums in upstate New York, just a couple hundred miles from where the Fox sisters grew up. It's called Lilydale, and it dates all the way back to 1879, when American spiritualism was in full bloom. But from the vantage point of people living there today, spiritualism is very much alive and well. This past summer, Seekings says, some 28,000 visitors came to take part in workshops and spirit readings and sessions of mediumship. In fact, attendance was at an all-time record.
Many people, when they come, for example, for a reading, are seeking. I mean, they are searching. they're looking for confirmation, validation that their loved one is okay. Sometimes they're looking for explanations.
So is spiritualism basically a religion of comfort?
I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
People who love us still love us, whether they're on this plane or in another plane of existence. So, you know, my mother, who was quite apt to give her opinion when she was on this earth and shall we say, intervene without request, nothing's changed. She's still quite apt to intervene without request.
That's Kara Seekings, a spirit medium living in the Lilydale community of upstate New York. You can find out more about Lilydale and listen to more of our conversation at backstoryradio.org.
Guys, Ms. Seekings referred to this phenomenon across cultures, and I was wondering if you could help me just pin this down to the American variant.
Yeah. All peoples throughout time have believed that there's a world beyond the material world we encounter. But Americans, in their can-do, pragmatic sort of way, have from the very beginning sought to engage with that world beyond through individual efforts, not through not through the clergy, not through the church. I think this is really part of the Protestant tradition.
Well, I've just got one word for you then that kind of, as they say, problematizes that, Peter. Think what it is that Kara Seekings is and what is required for connection with the spiritual world.
Right.
The medium.
Yeah,
so
that's a good
ironically,
point.
So it's Protestant wonderful. In the sense that it doesn't exist in a church. But I think what's strange about it is they're saying only a few people actually have the
but
gift.
But I think the promise really is that this medium is, in some senses, just the tool or the instrument, does not have authority. The authority comes from that other realm, and it's enabling people to hear a language they couldn't understand otherwise.
So it's like a Protestant minister who comes in and sort of hears what the Bible says. I'm going to translate it for you, but I have no real authority because this is between you and God.
That's right. And everything in between fades away. That is, institutions of hierarchy and control. Instead, this is the fantasy, and it's an American fantasy, that we encounter the cosmos on our own.
I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century history guy. We're spending the hour looking at how previous generations of Americans have contended with the spirit world. In the first segment, we heard the story of the Fox sisters, the two girls from upstate New York who may or may not have really channeled the dead, but who undoubtedly kicked off the spiritualist movement that flourished in the second half of the 19th century.
We also touched briefly on the way spiritualism dovetailed very nicely with the particularly American impulse to go it alone, to live one's life without the interference of authorities from the church or any other institution. Well, at the very same time that spiritualism was coming on the scene, another group of Americans was also starting to challenge established systems of authority.
The first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York, occurred just down the road from the first spirit wrappings, right about the same time. And a lot of the same people were involved. A lot of the people who attended the first Seneca Falls convention were also going to seances with the Fox sisters and seeking spirit communication.
That's Ann Browdy, a historian at the Harvard Divinity School who's written about the intersection between spiritualism and radical politics. And those radical politics weren't limited to feminism. In fact, Ann told me it was a small group of very active abolitionists who first took the Fox sisters seriously and helped organize the girls' first public seances.
Now, why would abolitionists and reformers care about spiritualism? This is the big question.
One answer, says Ann Browdy, is that many of those abolitionists were also Quakers. Like spiritualists, Quakers didn't have much use for religious authorities, and also like spiritualists, they were very much into the individual soul. Quakers believed in the inner light, that there was something of God in each person, and so the possibility of communicating directly with departed souls was, to Quakers, kind of like, well, talking to God. But then there was also that issue of authority.
What the radical abolitionists believed was that slaveholders were usurping the place of God by asserting their authority over one of God's creation. Now, once this issue of slavery raised this question about human authority over other human beings, that issue got applied in all kinds of other areas. And that's where we start to see the women's rights movement emerging out of the abolition movement. Spiritualists saw that when a husband exercised authority over a wife, that was also usurping the place of God. So spiritualists really pushed this idea of self-sovereignty, and they really understood it also as extending to the marriage relations. And this is where spiritualists get involved with free love. Now, when we hear the term free love, we think about a kind of libertarian sexual license. That's not what they meant. Often free love for spiritualists could result in a much more restrictive approach to sexuality because they believed that each of us has a spiritual affinity and that that's foreordained by God, and that if we are married to someone who is not our true affinity, that's not a real marriage. So if you found yourself married, as I believe many people in America have, to someone who is not your true spiritual affinity, they would condemn sexual contact within that marriage and see it as only something that could occur in these very special circumstances.
So Anne, here's another example of what would in Victorian America be seen as a transgressive, dangerous attitude that's become pretty much standard in modern America. That is the belief in at least the fantasy of romantic love and that spiritual affinity is pretty much mainstream.
I think you're right. That has become a very mainstream idea. Spiritualists are not the only ones who contributed to the notion of romantic love. Many strains of Protestantism did move in that direction in the 19th century. But spiritualists did push it to an extreme position, which is not that different from what we see today.
Yeah. So in many ways, when we think back to the spiritualists, there's a kind of a shock of recognition in their positions. On the one hand, they're at the margins. They are radical free spirits. On the other hand, we can identify with them, as their audiences could, large audiences could in the 19th century.
That's right. I think that in some ways it's easier for us to identify with spiritualists than it was for people in the 19th century, because the ideas of Calvinism, the ideas of infant damnation, the idea that one member of your family might go to heaven and another might go to hell, and that your immortal souls would be separated for eternity, those are much less familiar ideas today than they were at the time when spiritualists were challenging them. I think the large crowds drawn by spiritualists in the 19th century also reflected the time they were living in. There was no television. There wasn't a lot of excitement.
Right.
When the spirit medium came to town, that was something to see. And people did, whether they believed in it or not. They went out to see this. And many people reported that that was the first time that they had seen a woman speak in public. And many of them were very surprised by what they saw. And even if only a few of those people were converted to spiritualism, with spirit mediums traveling throughout the country, that amounted to a significant movement.
You know, in some ways, if spiritualists were challenging prevailing values, particularly in the Calvinist establishment, at the same time they were emphasizing family values because spirit communication was overwhelmingly with family members. So in some ways they were ultra-conventional in the emphasis on family values. I wonder if you could tease out that paradox.
You're absolutely right. In many ways, spirit mediums and spiritualism pushed to its logical extreme the direction that 19th century America was moving in, of rejecting separation of families at death. And we see that in the rural cemetery movement, right, where cemeteries are starting to look a lot like the suburbs, with family plots and beautiful green gardens in cemeteries where people can go to maintain those connections with their loved ones who are no longer with them. Spiritualism says if we can keep those connections after death, as many Protestants acknowledged at this point, then why can't we communicate? Why can't we speak to them?
That's Anne Browdy, director of the Women's Studies in Religion program at Harvard Divinity School. She's the author of Radical Spirits, Spiritualism and Women's Rights in 19th Century America.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and we're talking about spiritualism and other instances of the supernatural in American history. As usual, we've been inviting your feedback on Facebook and backstoryradio.org, and our producers have invited a few of the people who left comments there to join us on the phone.
Hey guys, we got a call from Ripton, Vermont. It's Brian. Brian, welcome to Backstory.
Greetings, gentlemen.
What spirit moved you to call us?
Well, that's pretty good. I hadn't thought about the cell phone as planchette before, but
yeah. Well, he thought about it for about 3 weeks, Brian. So don't be too impressed.
Okay.
Well,
so,
I had a couple of questions for you guys.
Great.
I'm thinking about spiritualism and contemporary new media. Mm-hmm. So not our contemporary, but 19th century new media. How did that impact spiritualism? I'm thinking of electrical platforms, the telegraph, the telephone, the gramophone, the photograph, and the different ways that people reacted to them, anxieties, to light.
Yeah. I'll just start off with a very, very brief mention of spirit photography, which was a big deal in the 1850s and 60s, and it was really believed that the right kind of exposure, so to speak, would give you images of spirits, and that this was actually a scientific enterprise to establish empirically the presence of spirits. It seems so crazy to us because we associate it with anti-science and superstition. But spirits and spiritualism was really pretty mainstream, and there were efforts by serious people we would call, and they would call themselves scientists, to establish the authenticity of the spirit realm.
And the telegraph was not unlike that. There was a sense that now there's a new medium, so to speak, to really connect the departed with the living, which is not so crazy when you think about
it. I like that about medium, Ed.
I do, too.
You like that. Okay, you guys are quick on the uptake. But the thing that happened was, okay, we can now send messages instantaneously anywhere and not be there with our bodies. Is that really so different from imagining that people who used to be here can now communicate with us? So really almost instantly from the time the telegraph was invented, it became imagined as the physical embodiment of how we could finally do what we'd longed to do throughout humankind, which is talk to those we've lost.
Yeah, and what it really did, it in essence eliminated distance that stood between two people being intimate. I mean, you couldn't have that kind of intimacy when you had geographic physical distance, but the telegraph really kind of allowed that in an instantaneous fashion.
Yeah.
You mentioned the intimacy of the telegraph, how you know, you're in the Crimea and I'm in Paris and you click and I hear the ta-ta-ta-ta. But what's interesting is that it's still very thickly mediated by Morse. It's non-tangible.
Yeah,
and,
very much so.
We
needed that so that we could invent the radio and television and have more intimacy, Brian.
Yeah, you know,
I feel more intimate already. But there's a parallel to this, which is that we, at the same time, this 1800s also sees the photograph, the gramophone, the telephone, which don't have that kind of thick mediation. I mean, they're immediately apparent. I mean, obviously, we can get all hermeneutic and talk about the different levels of interpretation of photography, but you tapping it Morse requires decoding it, if I can excuse the pun, decryption. But if I hear your voice on the gramophone after you have died, that's a profoundly different experience. Do you think that the medium in spiritualism is doing more of the former, being the decoder, the encryptor and decryptor, and less the latter, that immediate sense?
Well, the people who really brought spiritualism to the American population, the Fox sisters, ironically, communicated with the spirit world through something much like Morse code. It was knocking on the doors or somewhere in the room, or some people said their toes, but that would be a skeptic speaking. And so ironically, you know, when the first connections with others come through code, they're imagining the connections to the dead coming through code as well. And you're exactly right, Brian. What that means is that it requires an interpreter. It requires somebody who is the equivalent of a wire, who's more sensitive than normal people, someone who not only has the capacity to connect, but also the intellect to translate and to speak through them. So I think that's one reason the word was called a medium early, is because it was really all about the interpretation. So, you know, it's kind of funny, as people develop new technologies, the dead developed along with them.
That's great.
So they start out.
You never stop learning.
So, right. Exactly. It just shows, you know, that you're never too old to learn a new trick, right?
Brian, I just have to ask you, where does your very nuanced interest in this topic come from?
Well, I've been studying how people create fearsome stories about new media. And I've been, in order to understand the current generation of how we do this at digital media, I've been looking back at antecedents through the past two centuries.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm almost willing to bet that no sooner do humans invent a new medium that we also figure out a way of haunting it.
So how is the internet haunted?
In all kinds of ways. I mean, one, we have now it's actually pretty common to expect that social media services have provisions for post-mortem care for the data of members. So if you die, what happens to your Facebook? In fact, you can do a kind of nice digest of American cultural history by looking at what we think the internet is doing to us in a bad way. So there's this mix of child pornography, violence, Al-Qaeda, and copyright violation. It's a good question, what's worse?
That pretty much sums it up, doesn't
I thought
it
ended flatly, actually.
Well, thanks, gentlemen. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Great
Brian.
Call.
Bye-bye.
Well, our own website, backstoryradio.org, is definitely haunted by the spirits of a whole lot of listeners who have left comments about today's topic. I want to channel one of them for you guys. This is from David Hogg, who wants to know why spiritualism seemed to find a bump in popularity after major military conflicts like the Civil War, World Wars I and II. What do you think, Brian? Is he onto something here?
Yeah. I mean, we can just take the last 15 years or so. There's a Pew study that shows that the number of people who think that they have been in the presence of a ghost has doubled from 9% to 18% just in the last 15 years.
Wow.
Now,
your century, what's happening?
We're currently fighting a couple of wars, but I'm not really sure that's the reason. In fact, I would point to economic uncertainty, and during uncertain economic times, people are reaching out. They're looking for different kinds of answers.
You're suggesting there's a material explanation for the belief in the spiritual. Sounds very.
I always do, Peter. But you know, our caller, I'm inclined, knowing nothing about the 19th century, to believe maybe on the money vis-a-vis the Civil War.
Yeah, isn't that right, Ed? I mean, is there a lot of spiritual activity in the Civil War?
Well, there really was. I was going to suggest there are just twice as many ghosts today as there were 15 years ago.
But well, that's just the accumulation over time. I mean,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, in all seriousness, obviously the Civil War was a time of enormous suffering and loss. And we got to remember that the Fox sisters, that's only, you know, 12, 14 years before the outbreak of the Civil War. And so spiritualism is already going full bore at the time the Civil War breaks out. And almost immediately people start wondering if there's not some way to talk to our lost son, because you know, one of the horrible things about the American Civil War with the new artillery and other forces of destruction, that bodies just disappear or vaporized, and people don't have dog tags. And so, you know, that sense of longing is even stronger when somebody dies 1,000 miles from home and nobody has any idea where he might be.
And Ed, many of the soldiers who die are quite young. I mean, these are people who are just leaving home for the first time or who are recently established. Some are married, of course. But these are soldiers who never had a chance to fulfill their lives on Earth.
No, that's right. And, you know, the average age of the Civil War soldier is 21 years old.
Wow.
And here, these are people literally, as they would have said at the time, in the full flower of manhood.
Yeah.
And just when that comes, they are suddenly gone. So you would have found all across America, I think especially in the North, seances and unified attempts, not to mention, of course, many desperate prayers when people are alone, that they might hear a word of encouragement, of connection, that even though they had been destroyed on the battlefield before they'd had a chance to really live their lives, that on some sphere they were happy, that they were fulfilled, that they were at peace, and that they were in touch with their family back home. So, you know, it's not a surprise that Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln actually have seances in the White House to talk to their son who died not in war, but way too young. And when they did so, there was no great scandal that this was some, you know, rise of superstition in the White House. This wasn't some scandal, but rather another heartbreaking version of the same kind of conversation that people all across the country were trying to have. People understood the longing to talk to someone who'd been lost way too soon.
Once I had a child, he was white.